understand geopolitics, you must have the freedom to be honest. The More Freedom Foundation podcast.
Hello, Rob. How have you been?
Oh, not bad, not bad. Actually, pretty good, now that I think of it. I've really been enjoying the most recent Saudi Arabia output cut. Have you noticed this?
No.
So they, in the past couple days, to great fanfare, shocked the world with another million barrel cut in their production.
Oh, yeah, the OPEC cut, yes, I did see that.
Yes. And what's key is that they seem to largely be taking the burden of this onto themselves. They've figured out that Russia, you know, Russia's not officially in OPEC, but Russia's in OPEC Plus, has been, gosh, I think that goes back 5 or 6 years now. And Saudi Arabia's largely given up on Russia actually cutting any of its production. It's just going to spin out as much as it can at whatever price it can get. So Saudi Arabia just unilaterally, you know, went from producing around 10 million barrels a day to 9 million barrels a day. To be clear, I think this takes effect in a month or two or something along those lines. But generally speaking, what the Saudi expectation was and what a lot of people expect when this sort of thing happens is that these announcements have an immediate effect on prices.
Oh, yeah.
And the immediate effect on prices of this stunning announcement was essentially a wet fart. They have not moved much. I think that they're up maybe a couple dollars.
Well, I keep hearing, you know, fuel's now cheaper than before the Ukraine war started, things like that.
Exactly. And this was supposed to be Saudi Arabia's big move to get it back up into the, I don't know, $80, at least into the $80 a barrel range. And wow, has it not done that? It really, I think it's probably still up a dollar or two.
Yeah, but they nothing were crazy.
Yeah, like they were hoping for like a 10% move, something amazing. According to all the forecasters, we were supposed to be heading into this tighter oil market in the second half of 2023, and it ain't happening. And it's fun to see. I'm not gonna lie, it's fun to see.
How much does this damage themselves, or is it just more money essentially for them?
Well, this damages the Saudis a ton. I was reading, not in great depth, just on Twitter, some excerpts. About how this is similar to what happened in the 1980s, where they had, in the 1970s, they had an incredible amount of pricing power, and the developed world reacted by doing a million different things. Renewables weren't really a factor back
but
then.
But I think it definitely got a lot of those things starting.
Yes, exactly. We wouldn't have today's solar and wind industries without the 1970s oil crisis. But by the 1980s, the developed world had done enough to get more efficient, cut things down, develop, you know, some new sources in some new places, that they had lost that power entirely. And it's really bad if they make these kinds of efforts to sell less oil and the price doesn't go up. makes it a lot harder to build NEOM. But yes. Strangely, it doesn't seem it was. I just saw news right before sitting down to record this that apparently they had a merger with the golf, the PGA Golf Tour, or something like that, which is like not actually a merger. It seems like more of a purchase by the Saudis, which is kind of nuts. The Saudis tried to cut oil prices and it just didn't work. And that's a good bit of positive, satisfying news before we get into the meat of what we're talking about today, which is pretty grim.
Well, we had quite a grim episode last week, so I'm sure it must be a much cheery one this week.
Sadly, Rory, I hate to disappoint. It is talking about Syria.
Uh-oh.
We covered this a bit in talking about sanctions, but I realized that we hadn't really addressed Syria at any length on the podcast yet, and I wanted to make up for that. We did briefly cover, I think we had an episode on Turkey in Syria, maybe 4 or 5 months back, but just broadly, the Syrian civil war. It's a war that largely ended in 2018, but it is a war that the United States has maintained through its occupation of Syria and through its murderous sanctions regime against Syria. And I think it's worth just talking in depth about Syria. And the framework I want to use here is a bit cheeky. It makes people angry when I mention it, but I believe it to be the case. I think that Syria and Ukraine have a lot of parallels. I think that they're essentially, I think that Assad and Zelensky are two very similar figures. The difference, the main difference between these folks is that
Assad
Zelensky
can't sing or dance.
That's true. I hear he did not. I've seen some interviews with him, and he's not particularly funny either. Whereas Zelensky is a comedian. I think the main difference between Assad and Zelensky is that Zelensky has been targeted by a ramshackle shell of a former superpower and has been able to benefit from the support of all of the most developed countries in the world. And Assad was targeted by a very rude and powerful and vigorous superpower remaining at the height of its powers, the United States. And the United States was backed by every other wealthy country in the world. And I think these conflicts are very similar. I mean, just down to the way that things had worked. You know, if you look at 2014 to the 2022 period, it's very similar to what the United States has been doing to Syria over the past decade. The Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, you know, sort of carved out republics fighting against the central government. Well, that's exactly what Idlib and Rojava are. It's not an analogy that is well tuned to make people happy, but I think it's one that's worth paying attention to. And I think I'd like to make the case with this episode that the U.S. attack against Syria is really very much the same thing that Russia has done to Ukraine, with the principal exception that there are still rudiments of democracy left in the United States. So we were able to keep Obama from making the incredible mistake that Putin did in 2022 and escalating up to a full invasion. So we never did escalate to a full invasion. Washington, D.C. desperately tried to make this happen, and they could not get it through the U.S. Congress because the United States is still much of a democracy, and Russia is not.
Historically, what has American relations been with Syria, say, before 2000?
Really poor.
Oh, okay. It's been on the bad list.
Traditionally quite poor. It goes back and forth. We've been fighting with Syria over aspects of the Middle East for longer than we've been present in the Middle East. A large-scale U.S. military presence in the United States, in the Middle East, is a post-1990 type deal. During most of the Cold War, despite having really serious conflicts there, we did not occupy the Middle East much, but we certainly had political interests there, specifically the Lebanese Civil War, which we were definitely, with our support for Israel, we're definitely in conflict with Syria largely, though also we kind of acquiesced in the end of the Lebanese Civil War, which saw Syria largely take over Lebanon for a period of time. So it's very complicated, very, very fraught, but to put it simply, Syria was on the other side in the Cold War. They were very Soviet-aligned, and unlike most of the countries that were Soviet-aligned, they didn't use the 1990s or earlier to sort of slide back over to the U.S. side. They remained Russia-affiliated even after the end of the Soviet Union, which made them a target for us, and a target that we were... I hesitate to trot this out, but there's that famous Wesley Clark clip. You've probably seen it, where the guy who was the NATO commander in the 1990s, and I think pissed a lot of people off and sort of had his career ended, ran for president or what have you. But this is a serious guy. And he had a very unfiltered interview. It's got to be 15 years back, where he said that in the aftermath of 9/11, the Bush administration had a list of six countries that they were going to knock off because 9/11 gave them the permission to do so. This is straight from Wesley Clark. You can Google that clip. It's fascinating. And gets mentioned in my comments roughly twice a day.
Probably for good reason, to be fair.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So Syria is very much on that list. One key thing to point out here, and I think that I get accused of being an Assad apologist all the time, and I think that's, I mean, I guess to the extent that I didn't want to do a war that killed 500,000 Syrians, I guess I'm an Assad apologist. It is key to point out that the Assad regime, both under Hafez Assad and under Bashar Assad, his son, the current guy, has been atrocious. It's been a terrible, terrible totalitarian place, really grim, really, really nasty. But I think the key thing here, and I think what does not get mentioned, and I think is part of that mental trick that convinces people they're doing hero's work by targeting this country, is that while we have chapter and verse on the horrors that the Assad regime has committed, while we see this very present in European, U.S. media, Butcher Assad, what the nastiness that he has done, there's no comparative work here. There's no mention of the fact that the Saudi and Egyptian governments have done many of the atrocious things that the Assad government has done, as well as many, many countries in Africa, many, many countries. Most Asian countries have sort of transitioned out of that, but I mean, not all of them, and not with any liability. Assad is a murderous dictator. What I think gets left out is the fact that the world is full of murderous dictators. And I think that Assad has probably vaulted up into the, you know, top five position because of this war that we have, this war that is essentially meaningless for the average American and for the average American functionary that's pushing this war, but is existential for Assad and the regime surrounding him. He is a miserable, terrible, mass murdering person. But his choices from 2011 on have either been become a more epic mass murderer or die. I am not a fan of Assad. I do not think Assad is a good
relations
person.
Relations haven't really changed since the Cold War. They kind of just kept where they were. And once there was a chance to move in, America did.
Yeah, with backs and forths entirely dependent on the nature of the conflict. I think what makes Assad particularly, I mean, you know, Cuba's still out there, Ortega, you know, in Nicaragua. What makes it the hatred of Assad particularly virulent is the way that it interacts with Israel. At Israel's founding, all of the countries around it banded together to fight Israel in a number of wars. That coalition was principally Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, with most other Arab countries sort of adding support to one degree or another. But the serious military threats to Israel were Egypt, Jordan, and Syria. In 1979, Egypt made its peace with Israel. I believe in the mid-90s, I think, was at least when it became formalized. Jordan made its peace with Israel. And Syria is the country that always refused to do that.
The outlier.
And that is an added detail to our hatred of Syria. Specifically, the opportunity that was provided was the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring was very frustrating to the United States because nominally, I mean, we just had Bush and Obama to some degree talking about how great it would be if democracy spread in the Middle East. The problem was that when democracy spread in the Middle East, the easiest targets, the folks who fell the quickest, appeared to be the most U.S.-endorsed dictators. Ben Ali in Tunisia.
They're all the good dictators. You can't have them falling.
Yes. Our dictators kept falling. That was the frustration, right? Our dictators kept falling. So the United States decided, well, gosh darn it, it's only fair if we get to take out Gaddafi and Assad. And so that launched the policy. And it was successful in Libya because everybody hated Gaddafi, quite simply. Everybody hated Gaddafi so much that China and Russia acquiesced in a Security Council resolution that allowed NATO activity in Libya. This is a very key problem this is a key moment in the falling apart of U.S., Russian, and Chinese relations, though, because they were very key. You can't overthrow Gaddafi. I mean, we hate him, but you can't overthrow him, but you're allowed to intervene to protect Benghazi. And NATO said, yeah, yeah, we'll do that. We won't overthrow him. And then protected Benghazi and spent 4 months overthrowing Gaddafi, which basically killed the Security Council as a working
coalition.
As a coalition that could do anything about humanitarian crises where folks were involved. So there's that aspect. So Gaddafi was able to fall because everybody had always hated Gaddafi. He was a nut. Assad has always been tightly linked to Russia and Iran. So the
Has the
actions...
Iran links not been fairly recent?
No. And that I think that's a really key part of the marketing. Well, of course, Syria is a proxy war. And yes, it's really regrettable what the United States and Europe have been doing there. But look at what Russia and Iran have been trying to do. Look at their terrible, like, what Russia and Iran are doing is backing up an ally, like what we're doing to back up Zelensky. And Syria is one of the only allies that Russia had left in 2011, and certainly today. So that's longstanding, but the relationship between Syria and Iran is also longstanding. And that goes back to the war in Lebanon. Essentially, it's not as tight as it was today. Much like the U.S. war in Iraq, the U.S. war on Syria functioned to make Iran a much, much stronger pillar of Syrian security and much more tightly involved. But they were aligned prior to this invasion, for sure. And there were interactions between Syria and Hezbollah. I mean, Syria ran Lebanon between, I think, 1990 and 2005 or thereabouts. And during that period, Hezbollah, which is quite affiliated with the Iranian government, not only managed to grow and flourish, it managed to throw out an Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon. The Syrians and the Iranians have, the fact that the Syrians facilitated that was another reason why the United States and Israel hate Syria in particular. So yeah, this idea that like, oh, Iran and Russia, this was Russian or Iranian adventurism or imperialism to just jump in and defend Syria is actually, that's a completely inaccurate and ahistorical view of what was going on there. One of the main reasons that Syria was attacked in this way is because it had been affiliated with Russia and Iran, and Russia and Iran acted to defend their long-term ally.
Has Syria affected U.S. policymaking?
Well, it's in major ways. It's been the proving ground, I think it has made it very clear to Washington, D.C., that large-scale U.S. operations are not going to be tolerated. That the U.S. public, no matter how much it's willing to take...
You're not charging into Venezuela?
Yes. Exactly. No matter how much the U.S. Public is willing, how much abuse the U.S. public is willing to take to our tax dollars, our government, it seems to function as nothing else other than a war with Russia, war with China machine sometimes. We'll take that level of abuse, but we won't take our troops being sent into another Middle East meat grinder, which is what the Obama administration tried to do it. And has been pilloried ever since for not forcing the U.S. military into Syria, despite the fact that he put it to Congress and Congress said no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's nice. I mean, it wasn't worth killing 500,000 Syrians, but it is good that Washington, D.C. has an awareness that U.S. troops really, large-scale usage of U.S. troops really isn't on the table for them anymore.
Do you feel the best strategy for America would have been just to stay out of it completely?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think what's underestimated is just the extent to which the United States was involved in creating this war. There was the Arab Spring. There was a peaceful protest movement in Syria in 2011. It is, I have not done, there's such a weight of propaganda, not just propaganda, but also, well, legitimate reporting can be propaganda, but just honest, earnest writing from partisans of the Syrian rebellion. And that includes every Western journalist. These were my friends. I hung out with them. Huge partisans of the Syrian rebellion. These are peaceful, lovely, awesome people. So I haven't had the time to really just like, I haven't taken the time to really go through that first year, crucial year there, and identify the points at which it's like, okay, so was this peaceful or was this a jihadist insurgency? Like, so that's a sort of an open question. Almost anybody who's writing about Syria, I was reading USAID stuff at the beginning, and then like they really, it's a peaceful, peaceful protest movement against Assad, this, that, and the other thing. But if you look at like the figures from the, I think it's the Syrian Observatory of Human Rights, which is a very problematic, I would say problematic, but like I think most people use it as the best source for Syrian Syrian body counts or what have you. It's very anti-Assad. But even this organization concedes that in the first year, there were many more Syrian soldiers being killed than there were insurgents, which is kind of strange if you think about that. This is a peaceful protest that was being cracked down by a merciless government, and most of the people dying were the Syrian government soldiers. So that's a data point I've never been able to reconcile. But I also like don't take that too far. I haven't like a lot of people I trust, a lot of people I consider good friends. Consider that the this did come out of the genesis of a peaceful protest movement. It did start as a peaceful protest movement. It was cracked down on, and that's sort of how the war started. We had that in every Arab country, essentially, that potential. Specifically, in 2013, the current dictator of Egypt, Sisi, came to power massacring 1,000 peaceful protesters. An Egyptian would comment on this. They weren't peaceful protesters. They were violently occupying that square. Okay. Maybe. But also by the same token, then were these peaceful protesters in Syria violently occupying the square? Regardless, Sisi came to power murdering 1,000 people in the Egyptian streets. The president, the only democratically elected president in Egyptian history, died in prison. As well as hundreds, possibly thousands, of other Egyptian pro-democracy folks. But he's on the U.S.'s side, so we
don't
never
hear about
that
as much.
Never hear about any of that. So no question, peaceful protesters were getting killed very quickly, like within months, maybe hours, actually. It transitioned from a peaceful protest into a violent civil war. And I read this book recently, more focused on Turkey, but you can't talk about Turkey over the past decade without talking about Syria. And this is I think she's British or maybe American, correspondent who went to Turkey to cover the conflict in Syria. And I was like, oh man, here we go. Another, you know, the Syrian heroes, da, 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 da. And it was interesting because very quickly, someone who went to Syria out of like passionate, almost suicidally courageous commitment to the Syrian rebellion, who retains that commitment to the peaceful protests, her accounts of just like 2012 in Syria, so literally 1 year into the conflict, make clear that it was a jihadist nightmare. Like it was like the rebellion was already like she couldn't. She talks about not being able to travel in rebel-held areas without wearing a full head covering. She talks about her friends getting kidnapped and executed. So it very, very quickly became these rebels, these initial peaceful rebels who were worthwhile and good for them, were very quickly supplanted by violent jihadists. And I would argue that any serious analyst of this who knew what the politics of the Middle East were circa 2010, 2011, could have easily predicted that this was inevitable and this was what any kind of rebellion would have been. The standard response to this is, well, Assad let the jihadists out of the jail and did this intentionally is sort of the traditional counter to that. And it's like, well, if the opposition to Assad that he had jailed were mostly jihadists, I mean, doesn't that lead to, like, this was something that was always going to end up this way. I remember in 2011 being in Istanbul watching an improv troupe. I will always remember this. They were pretty good at improvisational comedy. And they put together this clip on the Syrian war. This is in mid-2011. And the character they had talking about freedom, 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 freedom was like beating his wife. This was written by a Syrian guy, you know, who was already a refugee from this conflict. And it was blindingly obvious to anybody who could read anything by not just mid-2012, but by the beginning of 2012, that this was becoming a jihadist nightmare. Everybody became very aware of this in 2014 when the Islamic State rose to prominence. Essentially, this open space that essentially the Donetsk-Luhansk thing, to continue the Ukraine analogy, that the United States had opened in northern Syria. Now, the United States didn't do this with direct troops. What we did this with was money. There's a CIA program called Timber Sycamore. You can Google that. The New York Times has covered it. What was much bigger, which was probably bigger and more damaging, is the Turkish jihadi highway. You've probably heard of this. You're basically any foreign fighter who wanted to fight against Assad. And a lot of these foreign fighters were motivated by religious fundamentalism, could fly to Istanbul, take a public transit down to the border with Syria and go and fight. And also the Gulf monarchies, who would actually started out funding competing groups of jihadists. So it was always a mess, but it was always a really nasty jihadist mess. And the United States knew this. Any sensible analyst at the State Department or the Defense Department knew this before we started supporting the rebellion in 2011. But in 2012, we just doubled down and we doubled down. And this is like kind of a key thing that I think people really neglect. But I was looking at like USAID. This is the agency that the United States uses to dispense aid. And since 2012, we have dispensed $16 billion in aid to Syria, which is great. That's lovely. That's good. None of that, I mean, not none of that, I'm sure some of that has gone to the vast majority of the country that has always been under the control of the Syrian government, under the Assad regime. But the vast majority of this $16 billion has gone to propping up
their rebels,
these Donetsk, Luhansk, you know, Idlib and Rojava, these mm-hmm. Donetsk, Luhansk style things. And I mean, like, that's like, on the one hand, it's like, well, yeah, we need, you know, we need to feed these people. There's millions. You can make an argument that maybe a quarter of Syria's population actually is in these territories, and they're mostly, you know, IDPs or refugees, and they deserve our support. But also there's like, you know, we're providing sanitation, we're providing government support to a lot of areas that are mostly controlled by Al-Qaeda. Like, that's not, like, so anyway. So we've provided massive, massive support. We stopped providing the military support in 2017, after giving $1 billion to a bunch of jihadists. But we still massively support these breakaway areas with humanitarian funding. And, you know, I'm not saying we shouldn't do that. But I think in any calculation of, like, how much money and effort the United States has put into destroying Syria, that $16 billion is pretty important. And then, of course, in 2014, we had the Islamic State. And everybody started paying a lot more attention to Syria. What we spent a lot of time trying to cover up was that the Islamic State were essentially U.S. proxies. were desperate to tell this story where there were like, oh, you see, there's this infinite number of sides in northern Syria, and it's so complex. And no, there's the good jihadists who are fighting against the Islamic State. And really, like most of which, I think people legitimately believe that. But at least with 2020 hindsight, it's like this is all just bureaucratic overcomplication to facilitate sending weapons to jihadists. Because if we tell a story where the Islamic State is fighting again, and don't get me wrong, these are militia factions. Like there was absolutely real bloodshed between Islamic State and other factions for sure. But like the bloodshed and then like the losing side would just join up with the Islamic State with all their U.S. weapons. So it's like, so we created this massive space this open field for the jihadists in 2012, 2013. In 2014, an Iraqi jihadist group, this is in 2013 and 2014, an Iraqi jihadist group, the Islamic State, came over to Syria because this incredible open space we'd provided, and they were the strongest and most virulent of the jihadist factions that we had motivated. So that's what the Islamic State was. People love to claim that, if Obama hadn't withdrawn from Iraq, the Islamic State would have never happened. And that's vastly, vastly less, I think that's wrong, but that's vastly less important than the jihadist open territory in northern Syria that Obama and the U.S. Foreign policy establishment put together. So that's really, really grim.
Is America, it has boots on the ground in Syria at the moment, roughly, is it 1,000, give or take?
It's, I hear 800 to 1,000, something like that. They're in two separate locations. So that's sort of...
They're protecting certain groups and individuals. So what's the official line that they are protecting? Because it's definitely not Assad.
To his credit, Trump tried to withdraw from Syria like three or four times as president. To his immense discredit, he did not have the control over his military bureaucracy. I mean, he just didn't have the basic competence necessary to get
things done.
His constitutional orders followed. We saw that with Afghanistan as well. Whereas, only Trump could propose leaving, but only Biden could actually execute it and make it happen.
But it also meant they couldn't invade Venezuela. So there's pluses and minuses.
I guess, man. I think it's mostly minuses. Minuses. So we've got the Islamic State. This is a big deal. What I think is really underemphasized is that the Islamic State was as powerful and as terrifying as it was because of U.S., Turkish, and Gulf support. Like, they were able to, crazy, a terrorist organization that controls territory? Oh my gosh, this was this new and scary thing in 2014. It was U.S. policy in 2012 and 2013, and so it was not described as scary as it was. So that's why the Islamic State was so, all of a sudden. And almost as soon as the United States shut down many of those funding sources and stopped covering for jihadists as powerfully as we did, not that we don't still to a degree, they rather quickly evaporated. That's unfair. The Iraqis, the Iranians, U.S. Special Forces, the Kurds fought a series of really brutal battles. I mean, what happened to Raqqa and Mosul is horrifying. I think there's estimates out of Mosul that U.S. bombing killed 5,000 civilians. There was really, really hard fought, but practically speaking, it was a pretty quick, pretty rough fight when the United States decided to switch from primarily funding and facilitating jihadists to fighting them. And it was over largely by 2017. Mosul and Raqqa had both fallen by 2017. The Islamic State had been reduced to functioning in the cracks between these differing power bases that had been set up largely by the United States. The Islamic State functions best where there are vacuums of power. And there are vacuums of power still in northern Syria because the Turks have occupied a chunk. The Kurds, supported by the United States, occupy a chunk. The Al-Qaeda jihadists, I think, still subsist on a lot of U.S. money, but are now almost entirely protected by Turkey. So that's shifted over time. But all of these competing forces create a lot of places for the Islamic State to work through. So nominally, U.S. troops, one of their main missions, they managed to snow Trump the last time by saying we're taking the oil or something, which is incredibly illegal, incredibly against everything, but functionally true. The United States military is blocking the Syrian government, which controls the vast majority of Syrians, from accessing its own oil resources. That is a functional thing that U.S. troops backed by sort of U.S. troops backing Kurdish forces are currently doing.
Is that partly why it said Syria is now almost like a narco state? I forget the name of the drug. It's like a German drug that's apparently...
Captagon.
Yes.
Captagon.
Apparently the Syrian state's now manufacturing this, and it's because it's got such little avenues to make money, it seems to be churning this out.
That's definitely an aspect of it. Captagon, is, I'll confess, is not something I've investigated at great length.
It's something that was very new to me as well, but apparently it's very popular in the region.
I think it's a big enough deal that it actually facilitated Assad's welcoming back into the Arab League, because the other Arab countries want to figure out a way to shut down this flow. But just to that Islamic State point, so one of the main reasons that the United States, you know, the United States can't put in paper, as they were able to lie to Trump about, that, oh, we're taking the oil, that's why we're doing this. So the U.S. troop presence, which was put in by Trump, actually, which is kind of
strange.
Trump has this reputation of being, oh, he didn't start any new wars. To be clear, throughout the Obama administration, there were probably significant special forces, deniable, brief installations of U.S. troops. But it's Trump that put, you know, first I think it was a Marine Expeditionary Unit, and then other forces. Like, I think it was Trump that, like, put the official mainline U.S. troops on the ground there.
Because it is a proper official army with artillery, air support.
I mean, I don't think we have air bases, but they are supported by U.S. air bases.
Well, just
elsewhere,
when I looked into what happened when America destroyed that Wagner group, they had the whole nine yards. Like, they were just eviscerated.
Well, I'm not a military expert by any, I don't cover it. But my understanding is that if you've got the right equipment and the right platoons on the ground, you can call in airstrikes as a U.S. military person from pretty much anywhere, you know, at this point.
Wow.
And yes, they absolutely obliterated those folks. But sorry, just this. So the justification, the main justification for keeping these troops in Syria, is our ongoing Islamic State fight. The Islamic State fight, the serious aspects of it, were over in 2017. Sorry, yeah, 2017.
Because when's the last time you've heard anything about them?
Oh, I mean, they're still there. But the reason they're still there, the reason they're still able to operate at all, is because of the chaos that the U.S. troop presence creates. So I would actually argue that the U.S. troop presence in Syria is one of the main things keeping the Islamic State going. This is very key. So I think we're up to our second or third Islamic State leader that has been killed by U.S. Bombings. Now, this incredible fiction, this idea that, oh, there's all these different factions that we're supporting. And, you know, you got to understand, the guys in Idlib, sure, they're religiously conservative, but they really hate the Islamic State. So the folks in Idlib, more or less affiliated with Al-Qaeda, that's where the last three leaders of the Islamic State have been killed by U.S. forces. So this is in the last vestige, the last place to hide for the Islamic State is a district fully supported by USAID funds to this day, and, you know, is supposedly the last free part of Syria, which is distinct from Rojava, the Kurd thing, which is a whole different can of worms. But yeah, so that's the Islamic State dealt with.
So are you saying without American interference, Assad would pretty much have full control over Syria?
Well, what happens when the United States leaves, which I hope will happen very soon, is that the Kurds have to negotiate with Assad, which shouldn't be that difficult. I think we talked about this last time, but put simply, like, the Kurds were not an enemy of Assad. They were not Syrian rebels.
And they did have an autonomous region within Syria, didn't they, before?
Not exactly. No, but they, what they had, frankly, so the Turk is really angry about the Kurds, claims that they are a terrorist organization or, you know, affiliated with a terrorist organization. The autonomy that the Syrians had was as a training ground for the PKK. The Assad regime has worked fairly closely with the PKK, with the Syrian Kurds, through the avenue of the PKK as like a foreign policy counter against the Turks. This goes back to the Cold War, because remember, the Turks are in NATO, very Western U.S. affiliated. The Syrians are Soviet affiliated, and the PKK is actually still has like communist, like strongly left wing ideology. So autonomy overstates it, but yes, the Syrian regime had always allowed there to be armed Syrian Kurdish elements to be used against Turkey, which is like the sort of backstory that nobody really talks about when the United States is like, gosh, darn, I don't see why Turkey's so miffed that we're supporting these heroic Syrian Kurds with their left-wing ideology. And, they're not the PKK. Whenever they take any territory, they fly flags with the incarcerated leader of the PKK's face on it, but they're not the PKK. So what happens if the United States pulls out is that the Kurds very quickly have to get back into bed with Assad, which is where they were up until 2017, when the Islamic State threat had been demolished. And the Islamic State territory was sort of sandwiched in between the Kurds coming down and the Syrian regime coming up. And then they met, and that's sort of where the conflict began between Assad and the Kurds. But it's not for the most of the war, the actual war that was fought in Syria, the Kurds and Assad worked together. Like the fall of Aleppo, that was Kurds and the Assad regime fighting against the jihadists that had taken over a third of Aleppo. So what happens if the U.S. leaves is that the Kurds have to make nice with Assad, and then Assad, and what's great is that Assad actually has an incentive to make nice with the Kurds and give them some degree of whatever. Won't be autonomy, but it'll be better than a massacre, because then Assad has to figure out how to get the Turks out of the country. And that is, that could happen next year. That could outlive us. Who knows? That is a very long and involved question. What's key for this, for the purposes of this, is to talk about what happened in 2016 through 2018. In the American imagination, the way it's written about, what made the Syrian civil war really, really nasty was the Russian intervention, which I believe started in the fall of 2015. I should have written that down. And that's the truly horrific, you know, start of the war. But really, that was the beginning of the end of the war. And that finished, I did write this down. So between... It was the end of 2015 when they dived in. Absolutely, the intensity of the war did pick up. But what also happened was that Assad started to very clearly win, was able to sweep the rebels out of the territories around Damascus that they had taken up and down the country. And I would say, so by 2014, it was pretty gosh darn clear that, or certainly by 2016, 17, 18, it was pretty gosh darn clear that the United States had no worthwhile Syrian rebellion folks to support in the north other than the Kurds, who were not actually in rebellion against Assad. In the south, that was a little less clear. The Jordanians had supported, the Saudis had supported, very heavily supported groups in the south who were not as scary and terrifying as the folks up north. And the expectation was that they'd hold out for a while and keep the war going. But then very quickly in the spring and summer of 2018, Assad was able to clear them out, both through usage of Russian bombers and also through negotiation, and essentially ended the war. So the Syrian civil war ended, really, in 2018. What we've got had since then, I think it was in March of 2020, there were serious conflicts between the Syrian government and Turkey over what is the Turkish occupation of Syrian territory. So this war has been over for quite some time. And what's kept Syria miserable is U.S. policy. Specifically, I mean, if you look at the timeline here, it's really atrocious. So in 2018, it's clear the war is over. It's clear Assad is securely there. So in 2019, the United States dramatically stepped up its sanctions against Syria. This was the December 19 CSER sanctions were enacted in a national defense authorization and came into force in June of 2020. In June of 2020, the Syrian currency, which had somehow persisted in over 9 years of civil war, promptly collapsed. The numbers of Syrians that were dependent on outside support from... So sanctions mean that nobody can feed folks under the Syrian regime other than the United Nations and affiliated groups.
Well, you were pointing out that countries still had to ask America for permission to help in the earthquakes.
Yes, exactly. And that's just horrific. And there were exemptions given. A 6-month exemption was given finally, weeks late after everyone who was buried had died. The United States deigned to allow people to do earthquake relief. But they're still announcing sanctions. I noticed on in this morning's research on May 30th, 2023, so last week, supposedly within the period of time of these exemptions, I'm not sure if it's the State or the Treasury Department, announced a whole list of Syrian financial intermediaries who are now to be sanctioned. So we are even now during this supposed 6-month break, where we're going to allow some humanitarian stuff into Syria because of this horrific earthquake, we are sanctioning people for transferring money. And yeah, the Al-Fadl exchange is being sanctioned. This is a Syrian financial company, is being sanctioned for having dealings with the Syrian central bank.
It seems sort of like hard not to.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how granular and merciless these sanctions are. The United Nations has for a decade now fed most of the people in Syria in the north. They have a lot of help from the United States and Turkey because, it's not controlled by the Syrian government. The amount of people that were being served by the United Nations was actually going steadily down from 2018 to 2020. These sanctions came in, and now anybody who wants to so much as sell food to Syria can't. Not explicitly, because explicitly in the legalese, we talked about this in our last sanctions episode. Officially, of course, you can sell food and medicine to Syria. But practically, if you're a business person, you're like, I don't want what happened to me. I don't want what happened to the Al-Fadl exchange to happen to me. I'm just going to steer clear. So what this does is it basically makes the entirety of the Syrian population entirely dependent on the United Nations for food and existence. And I was just looking at it that, like, the United Nations actually has to dial back because they're not getting enough money to actually feed everybody in Syria. So it is perverse. We lost in our efforts to overthrow Assad pretty conclusively in 2018. The Islamic State had also been defeated at that point. We're now talking a solid 5 years ago, the Syrian civil war was over and we should have left and allowed them to rebuild. But we refuse because we really want to preserve the option to have another $1 trillion war with Iran. And that's because Syria is affiliated with Iran. We see a value in keeping Syria as screwed up as possible. We're keeping it in this murderous stasis until Washington, D.C. can come up with a justification to get the United States more further involved in wars in Iraq and Syria.
What's the Republicans' take on this? There's, you know, I'm hearing a lot about almost like they're big into peace at the moment, but I sometimes feel that's just because it's a bit contrary to what Biden's currently doing.
Yeah, I think there are one or two legitimate peacemongers among the Republican Party. In the Senate, you got Rand Paul and Mike Lee, like legitimately interested in peace, take effort. I think Rand Paul was, I can't remember what it was specifically.
Would he be quite isolationist?
I don't like the term isolationist generally. Rand Paul and Mike Lee are both strongly libertarian. So I can't remember what it was specifically with Rand Paul, but there was some Syria related thing where he was like the lone dissenter, the only person to vote against it or something like that. And Mike Lee actually worked with Bernie Sanders and Chris Murphy, a Democrat, to do great work around Yemen. So there are a handful in the House as well of folks who are kind of committed, but not really. I think generally, I think skepticism about Ukraine is becoming a wider thing in the Republican Party. But when the rubber hits the road, there are very few Republicans who actually vote against any of that sort of funding. And these are the same folks who are like, you know, want to bomb Mexico. And and when it comes to Iran, they just default to their old like war on terror, Muslims bad approach. I don't see any Republicans
pulling out.
Yeah.
Helping Syria to go back to some sort of normality.
In fact, I didn't click on this, but there was a one of the news stories I was looking at this morning, this very incredibly minor, basic human thing that the Biden administration did, saying, well, gosh, after this horrific earthquake that has killed 60,000 people across Turkey and northern Syria, we will allow some humanitarian stuff to go into the country. That really just basic, minor, nothing thing, Republicans protested against. How dare you? How dare you let Butcher Assad get these funds or what have you? We're really just maintaining this. And I think
so. If anything, the Republicans would be worse.
I can't say that for sure.
Yeah.
Time will tell. I think. There's a chance, if Trump were to be president, I think there's a chance of like a broad-ranging slowdown of our, war with Russia plan across the board. He wanted to get out of Syria multiple times. So, I mean, if Trump's the president, probably it'll be the exact same freaking thing, and he'll make speeches saying it won't be, because that's what he did for the 4 years he was in power. If it's any other Republican, it'll be the same or worse. Yeah. For sure.
Tragically.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting here is that I think this is, I would say, a direct parallel to what Russia did in Ukraine from 2014 to 2022. The big distinction, of course, is that when Washington, D.C. tried to drag us into a wider war in Syria, the U.S. public said no. And we had enough wherewithal as the democratic country left to say no.
So there's a few more checks and balances in America?
Yeah. But if Putin were able to put Ukraine into this level of subjection and misery without invading of what we've been able to do to Syria, then maybe he never would have invaded. So, you know, even that little piece of credit, I don't want to give it to us. I'm leery to do. I'm not a fan of what the United States has done in Syria. I think I've made that clear.
What are you a fan of the United States has done?
I mean, plenty of things.
Just to leave on a more optimistic note.
I mean, I think that the U.S. hegemony has given the world an incredible 70-year period without great power war. I know that there's a lot of leftists who like to dispute or complain about that, and I've read those analyses, and they don't hold any water. I'm a big student of history. I read a ton about the 19th century, and as horrific as these sort of instances of countries that we sacrifice to the U.S. military-industrial complex are, it was so, so much worse. It was so, so much worse. And I think that the United States, probably more in the FDR era than in the Reagan era, provided a platform where, you know, if countries were willing to toe the line in a variety of ways, this incredible platform where countries, including China, which we'll be discussing next week, were able to build up great prosperity and success. It's not universal by any means, but I think that the United States has been the best hegemon that the world has ever seen. And I think we have the potential, if we can stop doing things like Syria, to make that wider.
Well, that's a slightly cheery note on an otherwise upsetting episode.
Well, I didn't mean to alleviate, right?
I don't know. Any research into Syria is just dismal.
It is dismal, yes. Well, come back next time. We'll do much more exciting new Cold War stuff, which everybody loves.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.